Welcome to From Caving In to Crushing It, the podcast for those who find themselves immersed in adversity and choose to write their story instead of having others write it for them. I'm Drew Duraney, and I'm your host.
Today's guest is John Graham. John Graham shipped out on a freighter when he was 16, hitchhiked through the Algerian Revolution at 19, and was on the team that made the first ascent of Denali's North Wall at 20, a climb so dangerous it's never been repeated. He hitchhiked around the world at 22, working as a correspondent in every war he came across. A U.S. Foreign Service officer for 15 years, he was in the middle of the 1969 revolution in Libya and the war in Vietnam. To the young Graham, adventure was everything, and each brush with death only pushed him to up the ante and to bury ever deeper the emotional life needed to make him whole. Then it changed, sometimes slowly, sometimes dramatically, including during one night at the height of a battle in Vietnam. At the United Nations, he risked his career, crossing his own government to support peace initiatives in South Africa and Cuba. Then came the all-or-nothing bet he was forced to make, fighting for his life in a lifeboat in the middle of a typhoon when his ship caught fire and sank in the Gulf of Alaska. For the last 35 years, Graham has been a leader of the Giraffe Heroes Project, a global movement inspiring people to stick their necks out, to solve public problems, and giving them tools to succeed. He's helped end apartheid in South Africa, avert a major strike in Canada, save what's left of the Everglades, settle a war in the Sudan, finding long-term environmental solutions in the Pacific Northwest, and build bridges between the Muslim world and the West. His books include a memoir, Quest, Risk, Adventure, and the Search for Meaning, and a web book, Denali Diary, an account of a 1963 first ascent that has become an epic in North American mountaineering. Enjoy the show. Hey, John, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you too, Drew.
I always like chatting with you. It's our second time getting to talk, and then the first time you had some wonderful stories about your life. So the audience is gonna be glued to the TV, the radio, whatever they're listening or watching on. So first thing, I always want to thank the individual or entity that introduced us. And there was not an individual on this. It was the LinkedIn platform. You reached out to me and we connected, and then we had a great first talk. So thank you, LinkedIn, for setting up your platform the way it is. It works very well if we use it for good. So, John, why are you here? You've got an amazing story. And, you know, I always mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that I believe life, you know, we're taught that life is linear. People tell us, you know, if you do A plus B plus C, D is going to happen. That straight line. Now, God knows that I did all those things and I still ended up in certain places where I never expected. So what happens? You know, something on the outside, an external circumstance kind of gets in our way. We're never really taught what to do. Ultimately, I believe there's three types of men out there. You have one, the man number one has complete blind spots, doesn't really notice his surrounding environment, sees what happens, says, oh, this is just the way it is, and just goes about his life, and he does end up with regrets. And then there's man number two, who has more of a heightened self-awareness, and he notices adversity, yet he says, I'm the victim, blames life for doing it to him. He doesn't change anything. And he's on his deathbed with a ton of regrets because he had the opportunity to change things that he saw. And then there's man number three. And that's who I have on this show. And that's why you're here, John Graham. Because man number three has a much more heightened self-awareness. And finally, he says, you know, I'm sick of being sick and tired. I'm not living this way. There's a better way to live. These barriers are not barriers. These are opportunities. A way the life is getting, you know, doing for me, and I'm going to do something different. Become a stronger man. And you are a stronger man than when you first started. So, John, if you could reach back as far as you need to, and tell the audience that defining moment or moments where it was either the tap on the shoulder, the whisper in the ear, or like I needed the 2x4 upside my head to kind of wake up and say, Come on, John. Life can be so different. I control more than I think. Tell me that story.
Oh, well, it's a story. I say to a lot of audiences that I'm lucky to be alive because the whole first half of my life was one physical adventure after the other. I was totally hooked on it, and I kept surviving, and each adventure was more dangerous and risky than the one before, so I figured nothing was going to ever do me in, so I kept doing it. The thing was, though, was that I was completely self-absorbed. All I cared about were these adventures and the thrill. I didn't really give a shit, excuse me, give a damn about it, about anybody else or anything else. So I was very selfish and self-absorbed. I was an adventurer and I lived on adrenaline, and it was a terrific life as long as it was going on that way. But I began to feel a certain sense of uneasiness, kind of like in my late 20s, I suppose. And the first real kick or slap alongside the head, as you put it, was in a battle in Vietnam. I went to Vietnam. I was a civilian, but I was in the most dangerous part of the country. I was the advisor to the mayor of Hue, the city of Hue, a small city in what was then South Vietnam, just 50 miles from the demilitarized zone. So it was a very dangerous place to be. And I was involved in a lot of dangerous pursuits. But I never believed in that war. I thought the war was evil. I thought America was wrong. And I could sure as hell see that we were losing the way we were conducting the war. America was just, it was a disaster. But I didn't give a damn. Why? Because it was an adventure. I mean, up to that point, my adventures had mostly been like in mountain climbing and dodging avalanches and stuff. And now people were trying to kill me. And that was a terrific adventure. Oh boy, that was a terrific adventure. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this battle in Vietnam, where the North Vietnamese almost surrounded the city of Hue, and I would have been killed or captured. In the middle of this battle, it finally hit me that here I was in the middle of this battle. I didn't give a damn about this war. I knew the war was wrong. I was only there for my own narrow purposes, and I was involved at that point. I wasn't a junior person. I had control over life and death. People lived or died because of things I was doing, and my motivations were that shallow. And I just all of a sudden hit me. How could I let my life be that shallow, where my adventures were more important than other people's lives even? And so it was a terrific moment. It was the lowest point of my life,
Wow.
and I almost died, but it turned out that I survived that battle, came back, and I was sent to California by the State Department because I had, it wasn't called that then, but I had a severe case of PTSD.
Oh, okay.
I would walk on the shadow sides of the street in Palo Alto, California, for example, to avoid sniper fire. And I went to, what they were then called encounter groups. That's where you sort of got together with other people and spilled your guts as best you could and tried to
Sure.
learn from other people's reactions. And it gradually, I began to pull myself out, but it was a long process, Drew. It was a long process. Because as a young person, I was, have always been, I think, a caring, compassionate person. But adventure was so important to me, Drew, that I had basically hammered sheets of plywood over my heart. I couldn't feel
Unbelievable. Yeah.
anything.
Right.
And those encounter groups made me drill through that plywood, and I began to realize that there was a soft and compassionate side to me, and that I could use my resources. And I had a lot of them. I was smart and tough, and I could use my resources to do good in the world. And so I began to climb out of that hole. Ended up a few years later at the United Nations, for example, where I was able to do quite a bit of good in terms of creating a world with more equity, less violence. One of the things I'm proudest of is that I helped end the situation of apartheid in South Africa, institutionalized racism. So I began to crawl out of that hole. There are other things that happened. I'm going to stop talking because there's more to say. But because there was a lot of backsliding too. Don't get me wrong.
No,
I
yeah,
got
of
out of
course,
that
of
hole
course.
and I kept
Yeah.
sliding back. But you ask about the seminal moment that
Yeah,
alongside it was
absolutely.
that battle. It was that battle in Vietnam where I realized I just couldn't sink any lower. I was so unhappy with myself.
Why do you, if you knew you had a heart and were empathic and wanted to do good, why do you think it got to that point where that shallowness occurred? Were there, was it gradual? Was it just like that? Because to lose that, something must have been missing for you.
Yes, there was, and I didn't realize it for a long, long time. But then gradually, more or less about the time I went to Vietnam, I was then, I wasn't a kid anymore. I was in my late 20s,
Yeah.
and I began to think about, hey, there's something missing. But I couldn't put a name on it. Couldn't put
Okay.
a name on it. I went to Vietnam as a happy warrior. I mean, I wanted to go out there and get involved in a shooting war. But when this battle took place, and it was evident for a while that I was going to get killed or captured, and the only thing that saved my butt was fighter bombers from American aircraft carriers off the coast obliterated the North Vietnamese tanks that were by then just 6 miles away. And so, it's like, okay, I've been given another chance. But at the height of that battle, I can remember putting my head down and weeping,
Oh,
literally weeping, not
yeah.
because I was afraid. Nothing
No.
scared me. I was weeping because I realized that my life had been terrible up to that point, that I wasn't me. And so the answer to your question is yes and no. Yeah, it began to creep up on me, but it was that battle. It was
Yeah.
that battle, that was the snapping point.
So let's fast forward. So the United Nations, you started to do some good and you helped end apartheid, which is huge. That's no small feat. What did you start to do to turn it around? And did you ever think of trying to make up for all that shallowness? Or did you forgive yourself for that and move forward?
Well, like I say, it was two steps up and one step back.
Okay.
But I began to realize that I could use the gifts I had and the newly compassionate heart I had discovered
Yeah.
at the United Nations, and I felt really good because I could see what I was doing was actually helping people, not a few people, but thousands of people, maybe millions of people, all the stuff going on in the so-called third world, poverty, disease. I was helping with that, and then ending apartheid. But then I quit because I realized that I was so consumed by that, at doing good. I mean, by then my life had really flipped, that I couldn't do it working for anybody else. So I quit the State Department.
Okay.
I quit the State Department, and I was pretty naive at that point because I thought that all I needed was my good heart. I didn't have a lot of street smarts, I guess.
Yeah.
And I started thinking that all I had to do was write books and articles, and I would end the peace. I would end war. I would end the Cold War. I was pretty naive about what
Yeah.
I could do, and nobody came to my speeches at that point. And I was going broke. But then I met a remarkable woman named Anne Medlock, who had started something called the Giraffe Heroes Project, called Giraffe because giraffe has a long neck, and sticking your neck out, of course, is the American idiom for taking risks.
I love it.
And Anne was looking for people who were taking risks to make the world a better place, and she was finding them and telling their stories. At that point, we're talking now early 1980s.
Okay.
Before social media, she was
Right.
using paper press releases. She was using vinyl records, any way she could to get these stories told.
Sure.
The whole purpose, Drew, being that, as you well know, when you tell a story, you inspire people
You
much more
do.
than my speeches were. My speeches weren't were not were a flop, but Anne's Giraffe Heroes Project was gaining a lot of adherence. I
Yeah.
mean, within a few years, she had a
Wow.
nice article in the New York Times on what she was doing. Anyway, I met her. We fell in love, and after a while, I saw the value in what she was doing. But I had one more hurdle, and I'll just tell very briefly the story because it's a long story. But I'm out of the United Nations, right? I'm giving these speeches. I think that I am God's gift to the peace movement. But then I start going broke and I get scared because I've used up all of the severance pay the State Department gave me. And so I was going broke and I needed to make some money. And a friend says, "Well, you know, you've always had a good gift of gab. Well, you can lecture on cruise ships." Yeah, lecture on cruise ships. They pay a lot of money, and it's really good money, and it's, of course, a great thing to be on a cruise ship. So I end up getting a job lecturing on a cruise ship. They didn't care what I talked about. I just had to be entertaining, which I was. And I took my then 13-year-old daughter on my first cruise, which was going from Vancouver, British Columbia, to the Far East and back. And all I had to do was give a couple lectures on foreign policy. They didn't care. I also, other part of my job was dancing widows around the dance floor, so they made sure I had a nice tuxedo. I had to laugh. It was so funny. Here I made this huge turn in my life from those
My
battles
goodness.
in Vietnam. I was dedicated to doing good in the world, and now I was changing the world one blue-haired widow at a
There
time
you
on the
go.
dance floor of a
What a
cruise ship.
stare on the dance
Ah.
floor. I love
I
it.
mean, you have to laugh. And it turned out that that ship, however, after 3 days up in the Gulf of Alaska, burned and sank. And long story short, I see my daughter rescued, but then I'm left in a lifeboat in the middle of a typhoon. I'm dying of the cold.
Oh my God.
And it looks like I'm gonna die. And but I'd always survive these tough situations. So I figured, you know, I'll get out of this one. But it got worse and worse and worse. I mean, we're in like 30-foot seas. And you know how 30-foot seas is like up and down six-story building with every wave and 60-knot winds, and we're dying of hypothermia. And at the last minute, a Coast Guard cutter rescues me in the middle of this storm. But only after I'd made a promise. And I wasn't a religious person, Drew, but I tell you, I realize I'm dying. I'm dying of hypothermia. I know what hypothermia is from mountain climbing. I'm dying. So are the other seven guys in this lifeboat. And so I try to pray, or at least to reach the all it is, or whatever I thought God might be. I was pretty indistinct at that point. And I got a message very clearly back from God or the higher power or whatever. And the message was very clear, like, "Oh, it's terrific that you finally turned your life around, John. Congratulations on helping end apartheid. But now you're backing away. You're lecturing on a cruise ship. You're dancing little old ladies around the dance floor because you've lost your nerve. Oh, you're afraid of going broke, so you've lost your nerve and your ideals are withering away. You have to make a choice. You got to get serious about being a good guy. You have to get serious about making that difference in the world with your skills. Well, you might as well die out here because the next 50 years won't be worth living." And I just looked up into the storm and I was beaten. I was totally beaten. And I just said yes. And at that moment, and I know this sounds like a grade B movie to your viewers today, but I swear at that moment, this Coast Guard cutter comes crashing through the storm and I'm rescued. Now, I want to just briefly answer the question, other question you posed, which is, do I ever feel that remorse and payback? You know, I don't. I'm a firm believer that there's a warp and woof to life, and things happen for a reason. And yeah, of course, I suppose there's a certain amount of sorrow at some of the things that I did, certainly the things that cost people's lives. But it was a path. It was a path, Drew. And it's a path that led to this moment. I do a lot of public presentations, this podcast. Before COVID hit, I spent a lot of time lecturing all over the world, big audiences, mostly of business people. So the audiences were skeptical, right? Who is this guy? I mean, this old fart thinks he knows everything, and he's now God's gift to the world. You know, so they are skeptical. But I started, if they gave me 45 minutes for a speech, for example, I would spend 35 minutes of that speech telling my war stories, telling my adventure stories, my avalanche stories, all this stuff, until people were pulled to the edge of their seats, and they began to realize that I'm nobody's fool. I've
Yeah.
faced more tough situations than
Absolutely.
a whole ballroom full of people has faced. So they listened to me. So in that last 5 minutes, I pivot my talk around to, I changed my life. What's important to me now is not what was important then. And it has been totally uplifting to me. And I've been able to do a lot of good in the world. And I think it's true for all of us that we're all looking for some meaning in
Of
our lives.
course. Yeah.
And you think you may have found it in money and power. Maybe you have. My experience is that looking for meaning in money and power, or adventure in my case, doesn't last forever. And there's something more out there. And you'll
Right.
find the meaning in your life, as I did, through some kind of service. And that's my message. The bottom line of every speech I give, bottom line of for my side of this interview, is that the most important thing in life is finding the meaning of our own lives, and that the truest, most permanent source of that meaning, Drew, is some kind of service, some kind of giving back, using whatever talents and skills you've got to make the world a better place, to solve some difficult and painful problem. That's
Absolutely.
my message. That's my message.
It's a
And
strong message, Doc.
I don't want to get political, but there's so much awful stuff going on in the world now.
Yeah.
I'm just telling people, look, there's something you can do. There's a corner of the rug you can pick up to
True.
help make your world a better place for your
Yeah.
community, your nation, the
Yep.
world.
Whatever you're, what you can control, go for it. Question for you. I want to go back to, you did say you fell in love. So did you fall in love with Anne, or fall in love with the idea that what the giraffe.org was doing?
Oh no, it was Anne. It was Anne. Oh ho
So what
ho.
happened? Did she fall in love with you too?
Well, our courtship lasted 24 hours. We were both members of a writers group, an informal group of people that got together to try
Yeah.
to improve their writing skills by
Okay.
reading snippets of their writing to each other and then critiquing.
Yeah.
So we were in this writers group, and it happened to be in to meet in Anne's living room. There were
Okay.
about 10 of us in the group,
Yeah.
and nothing happened in the beginning because I was still married to my first wife, and Anne was a very principled person, so nothing happened. She was just a
Right.
really nice woman, and we respected each other, and we both wrote rather well. And then something happened, and I can't say what it was exactly, except that one Tuesday, the meetings were all on Tuesday, I walk into that living room, and instead of Anne, there was some luminous being in the world. I think I fell in love in that instant. After the meeting, Anne picked up the cue, I guess, and she says, "Hey, does anyone want to go see the new movie that's come out? It's called Superman." This is 1982, and I said yes in such a loud and tough way that nobody in their right mind would also say yes.
I love it.
Anne and I go to this movie house in New York City, and I don't know whether I put my hand over hers or she over mine in the middle of that movie. But afterward, we went to an Irish bar, and then we went back to her apartment. I spent the night and never moved out. So the courtship lasted, very. It was very rapid, very rapid courtship, and we were like deliriously in love, and we would
Oh.
just walk down through Central Park holding hands, and then she started the Giraffe Heroes Project, as I said, and I got into the Giraffe Project, and I was skeptical in the beginning. As
Yeah.
I said, I thought I was God's gift because I could give a good speech.
Right.
And then there was Anne, a storyteller. I began to see that telling stories was a way more powerful way of changing
Yeah.
people.
Yeah.
Behavior. So then I joined the Giraffe Heroes Project, and we've been leading it ever since. But she started it, and then she motivated me. It took me a year or so to finally get it. And then we've been running it ever since. So the answer to your question is, oh no, falling in love with Anne was preceded everything.
Okay.
And then joining the Giraffe Project, and not just because of Anne, but because I saw what people have seen for thousands of years, the incredible power of telling stories. You want people to be heroic? tell them a story of heroes. People, I mean, troubadours, and
Absolutely.
I suspect Neanderthals around their campfires were
Yeah.
doing that. And so we were doing it. We are doing that. The Giraffe Project is still very much alive
How
and
does it
very
work
much
now?
more.
So now you have social media. You have a lot of ways to get those stories
Oh,
out. So
yeah. Oh, yeah.
tell
Yeah,
me
we're
what
all
you
over
guys are,
social
tell me
media
what you're
now.
doing now, what kind of people you're talking with, and how you're getting the word out.
Yeah. Well, now it is entirely social media. We've told the stories now of about 1,500, maybe close to 2,000 heroes so far. And all those stories, by the way, are eminently searchable on a searchable database at giraffe.org. So we have that searchable database available to everyone, not just teachers and media people, but everyone. And we have a program for kids, for example, that uses these stories to help kids, young people, build lives as courageous and compassionate citizens.
Beautiful.
So yeah, and so we've been doing that, and now for 42 years, and it works, and we're very in terms of social media, well, we're all over the place. I want to just put a plug in here for
Yeah.
my latest venture. I realized that I was mostly speaking to adults, and I didn't have a concerted audience of young people, so I started a whole program of short 3-minute videos on TikTok and Instagram,
Okay.
called, get this, I call it Badass Granddad.
I love it.
Yeah,
That's on
it's great.
Instagram and TikTok, badass granddad. I love
Yeah, and it's
it.
I urge your listeners to go on to TikTok. Right now, Instagram is paused because
Okay.
I can't get them to do the 3 minutes. They only give me a minute and a
Oh, that's
half.
right. Yeah.
I got 3 minutes, and I've done about 25 of them now. You can dial up TikTok and look for Badass Granddad. And what it is I spend, it's kind of like my speeches where I said I spend most of the time telling my stories. Same thing. I'll tell you adventure stories, all in language that a 22-year-old will grok. And then I pivot to some life lessons. For example, a life lesson on courage, or finding meaning, or perseverance, or controlling anger,
That's
or
great.
something like that that stems from the adventure story I've just told them. And then
Absolutely.
I end with a 10-second call to action. I'm so pleased because I've only been doing this for 4 months, and I've gotten as of this morning about 135,000 viewers.
Beautiful.
So I'm really pleased. I guess I'm an influencer.
You're
I'm not sure
a
what that means.
badass influencer. I
Bad
love
ass
it. I love it. I love it. I love
granddad.
it.
So I do that. I do a lot of podcasting. I write books. I've written 5 books, all of them more or less the same themes of leadership, courage.
Okay.
And I'm 82, but I'm not going to stop. I mean, why would I
Yeah,
stop?
you got another 82 years, John.
I
Come on,
got
come on.
another
Keep
82
it up,
years.
man. Keep it up. John, this is awesome. So, the audience certainly has captured the essence of John Graham. You guys are going to definitely want to get in touch with John. So, find him on Instagram and TikTok, especially TikTok, Badass Granddad. Got to do that. And if you want to get in touch with John, he said the best way is via his email, which is Graham, Graham, at giraffe. That's giraffe.org. It's a wonderful organization. So, John, I've got two final questions for you. All right. Question number one. You have the opportunity to sit down with young 7 to 10-year-old John, and you want to give him advice about life. What are you going to tell him?
Believe in yourself. I had a miserable childhood. I was bullied, and I thought I was nobody. All I had was that I was really smart. I knew I was really smart, but what I wanted to do was to throw a touchdown pass to be a to be to have all the girls like me. Nah, it didn't happen. I felt it was terrible. I just felt miserable. And then I was lucky enough to have one and several, but especially one teacher, high school teacher, who would just kind of like push me up against the wall and say, "Damn it, Graham, you have got more talent and you're a little finger than this whole friggin' school. You've got to believe in yourself." And he kept after me, kept pushing me. And he pushed me. He pushed me. He pushed me into Harvard, for example. He pushed me to do all kinds of stuff
That's wonderful.
that shaped my life. But so the first thing I would say before even finding your heart is find your strength. Believe in yourself. That whatever you think is not going right for you when you're 10 years old, believe me, it'll change. And so believe in yourself. That's the
I
first
love
thing.
that, John. Well, what a wonderful story. And to have a mentor like that, that's a blessing. So, switch hats. You are now sitting down with young John, the young businessman entrepreneur, and you want to give him a business advice. What are you going to tell him?
Yeah, my advice to entrepreneurs is that the real to for them to look hard at what makes their life meaningful. I mean, be really honest with themselves. Because for me, for a long time, it was adventure. That turned out to be pretty shallow. And I'm guessing that if your whole meaning of your life is about maximizing third quarter earnings for your entrepreneuring company or your company, that you're going to fall short. There's other stuff out there. There's ways you can be of service because, in my view, my experience, that's where meaning comes from. Now, does that mean you have to become a Mother Teresa? Absolutely not. No, you remain a successful entrepreneur and business person, and you produce a fair product, sell it for a fair price, and you're totally aware of the impact of your company and your work on your community, on environmental standards, on work standards. Basically, you're a good guy. And if you want to be a billionaire, fine. I don't have any problem with that. But do it with a sense that that's the subsidiary part of what your life's about. When they finally put you in that pine box, you want to know that you've made a difference in people's lives. And amassing a lot of money just doesn't cut it. So it's like, yeah, go ahead. I hope you're really successful as an entrepreneur. But use those skills, use those resources also to look out, see some difficult problem that needs solving, and then take some risk to solve it.
I love that, John. John. Wonderful, wonderful stories, and I know we could talk for forever. You've got some wonderful adventures, and your wisdom and experience is so much more important than the book knowledge that we get in school. So, I want to thank you for reaching out on LinkedIn. I want to thank you for being the man you are. Grateful that you turned over that shallow part of your life and turned, and rushed towards that compassionate part that you knew you had all the time. So I want you to take care of yourself. Keep doing what you're doing. Let's keep in touch. All right.
Yeah. One more thing. I encapsulate all of this into a memoir. It's called Quest. Your viewers can get it from Amazon.
Oh, you did it already. It's
Yes.
done. It's done.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
What's it
Yeah.
called?
Quest.
All right,
Quest.
Quest by John Graham. That's your my like memoir kind of thing or
It's a
biography?
memoir. It's
Autobiography.
the full title is Quest: Risk, Adventure, and the Search for Meaning.
Oh, I love
It's
that.
been out a year or so, getting, good reviews, and it's my whole up and down. It takes you all the way down to the worst part of my life and then shows you how I crawled back to end up doing something reasonably decent.
Wonderful. All right. We got to pick that up, everybody. All right. Well, John, you take care of yourself and everybody else out there, please take care of yourselves. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe and give us a review to help others find it. I'd like you to answer this question. Are you living the life you want to live, or are you living the life others want you to live? I'd like you to think about that for a second. Because I strongly suggest you live the life you want to live. If you want to learn more about what I stand for and my services and how I'm able to help many men get out of their own way, please go to my website at www.profitcompassion.com. Feel free to also email me at drew@profitcompassion.com. I'd love to have a conversation with you. Take care of yourself and choose to write your own story instead of letting others write it for you.